told that a few members are on their way. I think we should start. And a very good morning to everybody. DG and DDGs who are present here and members of the team. The court is showing me something that I can't see. So all stakeholders, we welcome. Is Salga here? Oh, yeah, okay. Okay, I obviously can see Eskom. EDG Public Enterprises, welcome back. I wish we had more time. A little bit of the afternoon. They've been good to conclude our discussions. So, I want us to start so that I can sit there and allow me to have some coffee. I started at a meeting where they didn't even give us water. So let's just clarify what we're trying to do today. I've been trying very hard to clarify what we're trying to do, but it does not appear that I'm succeeding to get through to everyone. I think we received those submissions over the last 2 weeks. We more or less know where each one of you stand with regard to the contents of the RP. You know that according to the minister's announcement, the submissions were up to the 27th of October. To be safe, 60 days from the 27th of August. I don't know what they plan to do beyond that. I hope all of you have made your. I hope all of you have made your submissions. I'll try. You'll hear me. You'll hear me. It's getting there. I must have my coffee. I'm saying, we don't know how much time the Department of Energy needs from the 26th, 27th of October, thereabout, to finalize the RP document. We do know that they will need some time. to bring it to finality and take it through the relevant processes. And we will see. They'll come back to present the final document here. The DG last week granted one organization an opportunity to still make submissions up to the end of November because of a miscommunication that had occurred. So we have really now come to the end of our public hearings. Next week we will make an attempt to finalize our report that will table before the House on these public hearings. Today, we are making an attempt to focus the discussion we had had over the last 2 weeks on what we consider the big issues in the IRP that we have had yourselves express your views around. We do not expect that miraculously there will be consensus on issues here today. The committee will, out of this engagement, will produce its own report and will take responsibility for that report. And we don't expect any one of you to take responsibility for that report that you're going to produce. But we want to you to help us to come to more informed conclusions as a committee before we finalize our report. So, over the last 2 weeks, I've been saying that there was a time in the discussions where in the democratic culture of South Africa, things were opening up into some sort of a rally. So so I don't expect us to have rallies today. We're not asking anybody to move away from the positions they hold. Positions they hold dearly. But we want to hear you out because we think it is not right for me to forward views without supporting them, without those views being engaged. And there are many views you have heard over the last 2 weeks. We want to have a more focused discussion so that we can engage those views. We think that we are in a position to see, as the discussion unfolds, which views, with all respect, can stand the test of scrutiny. Because we don't want to come to easy conclusions. There are many, many serious differences on many issues we discussed over during the public hearings. There are very serious strong views on what should happen to nuclear as part of our energy mix. Very, very strong on both sides. I don't think that we will find one another with the much of time on that technology and whether it is useful for South Africa as part of our mix. The one issue that frightens me most is the debate around coal. With many of you who came here say no coal at all, and others have come and say we can't just abandon this important natural resource. So it's a difficult discussion. There are many other issues that have been raised. I think we will go through those today. So the reason we asked DOE to start first, and we don't want them to make the usual presentations they give us here, because we have listened to those presentations. We want to understand. There are many accusations that have been made here. The very first one, people say, this thing you call this cost, it's not least cost. Because you've forced other things into the least cost. So it can no longer be least cost. When I heard other people say, oh yeah, but your definition of least cost can be very shallow when you look at it in the context of the spin-offs that different sources could have in the industrialization of our economy. Now, we want from DOE, you have read the document, people have commented on it. We want you just briefly to respond, we have been here, we have been listening, to respond, why do you think this is this cost? Why have we imposed 1,000 megawatts of coal on this? Why is 2,500 megawatts from the DRC part of the lease cost? So all of the things that we want to hear your rationale for coming to the conclusion that we have come to. You may argue that we think it's a balanced document. You want you to show us why, from where you stand, you think the draft as it stands had been well considered. That's all we want you to do. And in a sense, to rationalize explain many of the issues that have been questioned here during the last 5 days. The 5 days just began the other week. That's all. So don't take us through the document. We are sufficiently literate, I think we can read that document. Tell us, what's the rationale behind the things that we have done in the current draft? When we have done that, and we have listened to many of the people who were here last week and the other week, we will listen to them. Respond to the issues that you have put forward, and I'm sure once again articulating why the things they said during the hearings are important to be considered in the draft IRP. You have the right to ask them questions. But why are you saying the following things? The other day I was working out that it is going to be a kind of conversation where we can say, Professor, how on earth can you say such a thing to your students? It doesn't make sense. So that's the kind of discussion we want to have. We want to be civil in the discussion, but let us be robust so that you can help the committee formulate a well-informed report. That's all we're asking of you. We may still walk away with your views and not having convinced the rest of the people, but we'll have cleared you sufficiently so that we know what to put in the report. We also want understand the Department of Energy, where it is coming from, and they well know that where they are wrong and where we think they are wrong, we'll tell them so. So the time now is 10:30. DG, you can start. I understand that you'll start and then hand over to one of the DGs. So, please start. Don't take long. You know what are the issues that have been raised with the RP. Zoom into those issues that were raised here that people say they think are major problems in your draft document. Please go ahead.
No, thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable members of the committee, and stakeholders who have shown great interest in the process that the department has been involved with as per the mandate of the law. Chair, you have indicated that the document is sufficiently developed and also gazetted, and it was going to be critical that we provide some little context into how we have arrived to where we are this morning, so that the context of our engagements is actually not lost in the middle of various inputs being made in the process that the Department of Energy, led by our Honorable Minister, has been engaging. One critical thing, Chair, that we needed to not lose sight of is the fact that we are doing this work as guided by law in terms of the Electricity Regulation Act of 2006, and it is therefore compulsory for us as the department and also with various interested stakeholders that we do this exercise. So it's important, Chair, to indicate and the members of the committee that we're not engaging on this exercise just for the fun of it or just to test the ideas of people, but we're doing this as a requirement in terms of the law. And it's in that context, Chair, that we also appreciate the manner in which yourself and the committee has taken this matter as seriously as we have done so, particularly because the electricity generation and distribution landscape in South Africa has also significantly changed since the promulgation of the RP in 2011. And the country has also introduced various forms of energy mix through independent power producers, and technology advancements have also made it possible for end users to generate their own electricity. But also importantly, the rising electricity prices have made it substitutes for some generation for own use, and LP gas more visible options for many consumers to get into. It's also important, Chair, to note that electricity demand is therefore no longer captive to the national grid, which has always been the traditional practice through Eskom in the past. And all of this has put the department under extreme pressure to review our processes in line with the stipulated legislation. It is correct, Chair, to say historically when we're doing this exercise, there were a number of assumptions that were used in the RP 2010 document, and some of those have not materialized, or some of them have since changed, and it's a reflection of how dynamic is the sector that we deal with. Some of the key assumptions that have changed include, amongst others, the electricity demand projection that was done at the time, also the existing ESCOM plant performance in terms of installed generation capacity, as well as the cost of various electricity generation technologies. So, Chair, but without getting into details, we'll try to reflect as we're starting this exercise in 2015 with consultations that we have done from a departmental perspective between December 2016 and March 2017, how some of the assumptions that we have made have come into the gazetted document that we did. Of course, Chair, without losing sight of the inputs that have been used in the last 2 weeks, as you have indicated, Chair. We did an exercise in 2016 and 17. This was a continuation of what we have already done. And some of the assumptions that we are making in our presentation in terms of our conclusions are informed by those processes, not necessarily by the views of the department. I think it's very important, Chair, to indicate that. It's also important, Chair, and I know that this might sound like we are going to have a continuous review of our RP, but the fact of the matter, Chairperson and Honorable Members, is that the unprecedented rate of change and technological breakthroughs and advancements, together with the scale of the disruptions that comes with it, makes it extremely complex to undertake a very long-term planning, and it's also risky to make rigid future investment decisions with the manner in which these advancements are happening. So the assumptions that are being made today should be read in the context that in the case of RIP, for example, it might soon be very invalid or shorter be realized away from the context at which it was envisaged when they were made. So I think that is the reality that we're dealing with, and this is not a local phenomenon. This is a global phenomenon in the energy space, and we are therefore not going to be rigid in whatever final assumptions that we make, no matter how scientific they may appear or they may look or they may sound as we present. But we are very clear as a department that these changes may occur now and again. And I was quite happy to hear in the presentations that some recommendations are being made that maybe we reduce the period within which we review our RP plan so that it remains dynamic, it remains relevant, and it talks to the changing environment that is beyond our control. Whilst this can lead to analysis paralysis, the solution for a robust RP lies in a plan that should be flexible, adjustable, without minimal or additional cost to the taxpayers and the consumers. And that is where the minister as well, from time to time, will be expected, as and when is expected, because of the changing environment at any given moment, to make the necessary determinations that could assist us to remain relevant and dynamic in the manner in which we manage our sector. So it's very critical, Chair, and I think it talks to your point that we are not here to contest a particular energy mix, but we are here to say what could work and work better and still be reviewed at a shorter period and be adjusted should the need arise. So that we are not in a rigid mode of thinking. Otherwise, once you get into that box, you'll make the work of the department very difficult to provide the necessary policy adjustments that we are empowered to do from time to time in terms of the law. So I felt, Chair, let me just give that context, and the DDG will provide some of the responses on the questions that have been raised in the hearings that we have been here. As you know, the team has been sitting throughout the sessions, and we have noted some of those, and we have identified some of the areas that we thought we should respond to, as we have also highlighted that, Chair. And without waste of time, as we have indicated, I'll hand over to him to go straight into those issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and Members of the Public. I will go through the presentation as guided by the Chair. I'm going to skip some of the slides. The focus, Chair, I'm going to focus on some of the key assumptions that actually came into question last week, and also and quickly go into how we actually, in terms of the scenarios that we conducted, how we actually got to the conclusions that we actually proposed or made on the day. I think as DJ had indicated, we started this process around 2014. And around 2016, we basically went out on public consultations, and the aim at the time was to consult specifically on assumptions. And that was purely because our understanding or our view is that when it comes to long-term planning, when it comes to planning, it's less the output that is contested, but it's actually the input, which are the assumptions that go into the plan. We spent about 3 months at a time, I think from December to around March, December 2016 to around March 2017, where we went around the country to various provinces where we had public consultations. We received a number of submissions that related to the assumptions that we had made at the time. And without going into the detail, we spell out, it's there in the report as one of the answers, how we dealt with those inputs. But basically then we adjusted the assumptions in line with the input that we had received. And around then, late beginning 2016 into 2017, we then started to conduct the detailed analysis in terms of the various scenarios. So basically, as you see, the IRP and the output is the work that happened mostly in 2017. And as I indicated, and as DG has indicated, is that the landscape is changing, obviously, very fast. So you'll find that if you see today, some of the assumptions might have slightly changed. And that's the reality. If we delay even further, I can tell you that by the time you sit into next year, your assumptions might not be realistic. And I think the point that the DG made, it's less about the assumptions. You obviously want to get them as close as possible, but it's more about the plan that you have on the table. How flexible is it to the changing assumptions? And that's how we try to do the assessment. In terms of the key assumptions, Chair, one of the key assumptions that was challenged or that was presented last week, there was an issue that came up around demand, which is one of the biggest drivers. Chair, specifically, there's a picture that was shown, and I think this is where I think we also need to be alive to the fact that when it comes to data or historical data, you know, depending on how far I show you, a different picture can emerge. There's a picture that was shown last week. We showed the relationship between GDP and electricity up to the year 2000. And that picture showed that there is direct sort of correlation between electricity demand and GDP across the world. But we obviously look beyond that. We look at the South African information as captured by States SA. And what do we see? One of the first things that we see is that our GDP projections, as we had them in the RP 2010, is in the red solid line up, have not materialized. The actual data is what you see in the bottom red line with the markings, this line here. So you can see that the growth we had assumed in that plan did not materialize. The second thing that we see is that in actual electricity demand, the blue line in the second graph is what we had projected in terms of the IRP 2010. And the bottom red line is the actual electricity demand that was realized. The third graph shows something different. The red graph that you see with going down over the years is actually electricity intensity. This graph shows you that from around 2008, there has been a decoupling between electricity intensity, and while GDP continued to grow, electricity intensity dropped. So, which means that obviously you got more with less energy. That's the first thing. But if you also look at electricity, you'll see that the electricity consumption had actually remained flat. So that relationship that was shown at the time indicates that others actually assigned this to the changing economic structure. They say that there's a changing economic structure where basically it shows that something else in the economy is becoming more dominant in terms of your GDP basket. So, Chair, I wanted to indicate this picture because there's a view that what we should be doing is building as much energy and demand will follow. But we're saying if you look at the information or the statistics that you have, there is a slightly different picture. And this is driven by many things. The fact that people have, due to increasing prices, people have undertaken energy efficiency. Due to increasing energy prices, people have started looking at, even load shedding, people have started looking at alternatives. Technology disruption that the DG mentioned. Obviously, where we traditionally came from centralized generation, we are now in a state where actually people can do distributed generation. People can generate close to the load. And it has made it possible for people to generate their own power, whether through a third party or through their own doing. So these are some of the drivers. So what we wanted to highlight here is that that relationship in the context of South Africa, the data indicates that it does not necessarily hold anymore. And that was the basis of the forecast that we do. In terms of the demand forecast that we've done, our demand forecast is based on what we call sector forecast. Basically, a number of scenarios are done by looking at the various sectors. One of the scenarios is what we call the same sort of base, where basically you keep the intensity as it was originally, as if it's growing. The other scenarios is where you actually go for a less intense but high GDP growth driven by something else. So in terms of the demand that we eventually came to share, it was based on what we call the high less intense. It's high. If you look at the GDP, I think it's an average GDP of just around 4%. But if you look at the intensity, it's lower electricity intensity, which basically assumes that other sectors in the industry which are less electricity intensive are also contributing to the GDP. So, and I think there's also this debate around the GDP and the relationship between electricity. Obviously, that correlation depends on the assumption you make around the intensity of electricity in your economy. Chair, the other assumptions, key assumptions that are important, has to do with the Eskom plant availability factor. What we used in the IRP, this information, by the way, the Eskom plant performance factor is what we received at a time, and as I indicated, I mean, we started this process around 2015. I think we got this information around 2016 or so. Eskom at the time they were looking at three scenarios. The bottom one, which is blue, is what they had statistically extrapolated where they were, and they said if things don't improve, this is where they see themselves remaining in terms of plant performance going forward. Then, based on the plans that they had in place at the time, then they came up with a red line and said if their plans fall into place, they will be able to improve their plant performance to what you see in the red line, where basically they were indicating that by around 2021, 2022, they believe that plant performance will be back at the levels of around 80%. And this is at a time what they had actually compacted themselves with DPE. So we used information that was actually acceptable information at a time. Without wasting time, I'll also move to the third bar. The third bar shows what we call the decommissioning, the 50-year life. And Chair, this table is in line with what Eskom had submitted to the Department of Environmental Affairs at a time when they were filing for extension in terms of air quality abatements. They had indicated that they need to retrofit certain plants because they still had a life. And as you can see, some of the plants, the red is where they were saying, they were indicating the retrofits that they needed to do. And you can see that for some of the plants, there was nothing because at the time they looked at it and they said that there was no value for money, obviously because they are going to retire those plants starting at that point in time. So the 50-year that we assume in the plan, it's not a DOE position. It's what was submitted through and we use that as a starting point. So it's not a position that's imposed by DOE and Eskom to shut the plant. It's what was committed in line to say, if we have to meet air quality, Eskom has to meet air quality requirements. They had said we can spend money because we believe there's still more life on some of the plants. Some of the plants we believe that it's not going to be worth it, so we're going to shut them down. So we followed the same schedule. That's basically where we came from. And this graph here, I'm going to skip, but it's basically in the plan. This is the cumulative. If you take the picture that I just showed you, it's the cumulative megawatts that is going to be decommissioned in line with that plan. So it's nothing different. I spoke about the forecast as well. It's detailed. The report is there in the IRP. I'm not going to go into the detail. Chair, so having done this, then we conducted a number of scenarios. We tested a number of scenarios in terms of or test cases in terms of the studies, and we ran scenarios based on the different growth trajectories that are in the plan: the high, the moderate, and the low. We ran what we call the gas scenario, and the gas scenario is where we actually played with the price of gas, where we had initially, in the initial base case, we actually increased the price of gas with inflation, but we then realized that that's actually, if you're likely to get gas, if it's not indigenous gas, it's going to be gas from the spot market, so you're going to be exposed to the changes in the price. So what we did, we looked for projections of gas prices going forward. At the time, we found a report by the International Energy Agency, and we used that, the trend that was out of there, to impose the gas price going forward. So that's the scenario that we ran. We also ran what we call the renewable scenario. The renewable scenario was because in our initial case, we had maintained the 1,000 megawatts and the 1,600 megawatts annual build limits in the plan compared to, that were there in 2010. But then we ran a case where we completely removed these renewable limits. And just to give context around these limits, these were the limits that came from the 2010 plan. And for those who want a sense of magnitude, if you assume that a PV plant takes about 24 months to commission, at any point in time, what this assumption for 1,000 megawatts of PV, if you assume 50 megawatts per plant, it means you're looking in 1,000 megawatts, you're looking at about 20 plants at any point in time. If you are running them parallel, it means at any given year, you could be constructing or under construction of about 40 plants across the country. So that is the context as well in terms of the magnitude of this sort of size of the 1,000, if I have to put it into context. So we ran a scenario for that. But what we also did, we ran a scenario because our colleagues from Environmental Affairs told us that they were looking at a new strategy for emissions targets. What we had used inherently in the IRP, which was in 2010, is what we call the peak plateau decline. In terms of the peak plateau decline, there was a target which was set to say that emissions from the energy sector will peak at a certain point as we complete Medupi and Kusile. They will plateau for a while, and then as we decommission aging plants and introduce cleaner form of energy, it will decline over a period of time. So with the carbon budget, it's a slightly different method, which we try to explain as well, where basically Environmental Affairs gives you, they had proposed almost like a 10-year budget. How you get there, the other one is more of a ceiling. This one is, it doesn't matter how you get there, but you must be there by the end of a specific period, say by 2030. This is the target reduction that you should have done. So we tested that as well as a scenario. Chair, I think it's also opportune for me to also indicate that there's another scenario that we wanted to test, which was the scenario around at the time, because when we were discussing with the ESCOM management at the time, they were talking about the possibility of extending ESCOM plant life. But obviously for us to test that, we needed information around the associated costs and the work that needs to happen. And unfortunately, that information, even after follow-ups, never came through to us. So hence, that scenario was never actually tested, because the information was never provided for us to be able to know what are the associated costs, you know, that we need to model. Chair, having said that, then we ran these scenarios, and the plan that came out of the model is the one which we call the least cost. And we take note of the point that was made last week, and I think it was a valid point to say that we never defined our what we meant by least cost, you know, and we understand, because then everyone has a different view in terms of that. So we take that, which was a shortcoming in the report, that we did not include what is our definition of least cost, so that everyone moves from the same position. And Chair, what I've attempted to do here in this presentation is just to indicate from where we're sitting, we consider least cost to refer to the cost associated with the cheapest combination of generation technologies to meet the projected electricity demand for the period under study. This is therefore not a user tariff, but an estimated unit cost of electricity of generation level, taking into account capital and operating costs that you've assumed. Where available, also including externality costs associated with that particular technology. That is basically our definition of basically the least cost that we used here. And others talk about this least economic cost and this least financial cost. This is more the least financial, which is more on, we are looking at the unit cost of electricity, you know, that you come out of this. And Chair, just to digress a bit, I think for me this is where the issue around South Africa, we talk about, we need to have a debate around the cost of electricity in the context of saying South Africa is a mineral endowed country. If we are to beneficiate, we can only do that by ensuring that we have the cheapest cost of electricity. So I think that there needs to be an understanding that every time you load requirements, I mean, and you'll see when you explain later, regardless of whatever you do, whether it's beneficiation, localization, those are additional costs. And those are additional costs that gets passed on to the consumer. So at some point, we need to make a decision, where exactly do we want to catch the jobs? Because the reality is that what we're sitting with, we recently had to, minister had to sign a frame, what we call short-term framework for electricity pricing. And that was meant to make sure that Eskom, with the additional extra capacity that they have, they can actually provide it at cost to ferrochrome smelters, because they are closing down or they are planning to leave the country because they cannot, they are not sustainable at the current electricity cost. So I think when we have this discussion around the various technologies and the benefits that come with it, I think we need to have it in the context of agreeing where exactly are we trying to maximize the benefits in terms of the country out of the whole value chain, and not just the electricity value chain, but even outside of that value chain. And I'm digressing, but I thought I should actually just make that point, Chair. So, Chair, based on our definition of least cost, then what we did in terms of the input that we put into the model, the plan that came out is this. And Chair, again, let me take this opportunity to make a point. Last week, there was a point that was made around the fact that a model is a model and all that. Chair, and later there's a slide that I've put in here. I think, Chair, the discussions from some of the quarters have trivialized the whole power system analysis and planning concept. Is that people assume that anyone with a spreadsheet or a software can plug the numbers, they get the results, and then you take the output and you run with it. There's a lot of interpretation of the results, and most of it requires experience with power systems. You know, you need to know how your system works and operates for you to be able to interpret the results. So there's a lot of interpretation. So the notion that it's plug and play and people take the numbers and then they plug them into the table is actually incorrect. There's a lot of analysis that goes into the output from the model. So, Chair, having said that, the least cost plan, based on the cost we had assumed, we had indicated that then the model shows that you come out with a combination of PV and wind. And, Chair, at this point in time, you'll see that on this first table, there's a blank space between 2020 and, I'd say, to about 2025. One of the base assumptions, so the things that we fixed in the plan, is that everything else that's been committed to, including Medupi, Kusile, and the 27 projects, are a done deal and they're commissioned as planned. So we're not showing them in this table, but in the next table we'll show them. So that space is occupied by those. And if you look at the graph, if you look at those numbers, because the last projects come in around 2021, 2022, it seems to suggest that you come out of that period with a bit of extra capacity. And what the model says, it says that can you still maintain with the projected demand that we're doing and some decommissioning, it says you can still go a few years without doing anything, you know, if you're looking at the lease cost. And then, boom, around 2025, you need some gas. But that gas as well, I'll show later, it's more gas for peaking. It's not so-called base load. It's peaking plant. And later on, you then see renewables coming in. So basically, that's there is, while it's about price, it's normally about price, but it's also about what the system requires. So there's a system requirement from a demand point of view. I think while the debate has generally been to think that it's about price, there's what the system requires, because the system has got certain characteristics and it requires certain kind of technology to, certain types of technologies will be the cheapest to fill that gap. Not necessarily from price, but because of the profile of that gap, certain technologies will be the most appropriate to fill in that gap. For example, gas is expensive, but because gas, you can switch it on and off in short period of time, gas works better for peaking than as an example. So then, Chair, what we did then, that was the plan. What we're showing on the side and the bottom graph with the this chart here shows the various costs associated with the, we ran a number of scenarios and they were projecting the cost associated with one of those, each one of those scenarios. And when we say it's lease cost, this bottom blue one is what we call the lease cost profile. And the lease cost, it means in the long term, that's your trajectory for electricity based on that combination of technologies. I'm not going to go into the details of this, but what we're trying to summarize here is that from the studies that we have done, some of the things we had noted was that the pace and scale of new capacity developments needed up to 2030 compared to 2010 have to be curtailed because demand is not at the levels of 2010. That's the first thing, Chair. The second thing that we looked at was that I think we had determinations for the entire 2010 IRP. So we're saying those determinations will have to be looked at in line with what the new sort of projections are showing. And what we also noted, we said, what we see out of the scenarios we've studied is that because of the cost of combination of renewables and gas, if you don't make a policy intervention, you may never deploy other technologies like nuclear, like coal that we have in South Africa. So we do highlight that there is a shortcoming in just looking at cost because you may not be able, so there is a need for a policy intervention. But Chair, what we also noted was that out of all the scenarios, pre-2030, because of the limited space that is available, there is not much variation. Even when you play with projected demand, there is not much difference or change between the various scenarios. Your energy mix remains fairly the same. It's made up of mostly gas and renewables. Post 2030, the picture changes. Once you start changing your assumptions, different types of mixes starts coming in. I think there was a point that was also made last week to say suddenly nuclear appears post 2030, and it's precisely because once you start fiddling with certain assumptions beyond that period, because of, for example, you are now, I mean, most of the coal fleet is actually going offline. So there is more capacity at base load that is sort of coming out. So you are seeing that mix. And based on that, we then made the recommendation to say, because the mix doesn't change much before 2030, and because the space beyond 2030, based on the projections we're making now, is very limited, we can actually sort of, for policy certainty, confirm the plan up to that period. But post-2030, because of the things that we see, we believe that a whole lot of discussions and studies, you know, discussions like this, Chair, needs to happen, and outside of the RP process, because it's not, we believe that it's not just about doing a study, publishing it, and then everybody agree. There's lots of engagements that needs to happen. And the approach that we took was to say these engagements will have to happen outside of the IRP process. But because of the policy certainty and the gap that we have created, because there's no policy, there is no so-called updated IRP, we have said up to 2030, let's agree on a plan. But we do acknowledge that there are issues that we need to start talking about. And specifically, some of the studies or some of the things that we felt needs to be looked at, we acknowledge that if you look at one of the paths going forward, it involves a huge quantum or huge quantity of gas. And we're saying detailed analysis of gas supply options, international, local, to better understand technical and financial risks and required mitigations if we are to take a renewable energy path, dominated path, needs to be understood for that period. So we had said that before the next iteration, this is some of the work that needs to happen. So we had proposed work around gas. We have proposed work around the correct, the appropriate level of penetration of renewable energy. I mean, having discussed with someone at System Ops, I mean, they have indicated that, I think, up to the levels of about, I think they had said 15 or 20% or so, which is up to 2030, they don't see the problem. But they believe that if we continue beyond 2030, there may be a whole lot of other technical issues. And, Chair, by the way, some of these studies have been done by various institutions. What has not happened is robust debates around the studies so that they can be formally adopted. And so hence we're saying some of these discussions needs to happen so that when you move forward and we do the next iteration of the RP, these things are on the table. We talk about detailed analysis of other clean energy supply options. And this, by the way, was even a call in the 2010 IRP. Unfortunately, I don't think there is something concrete we've put on the table and we've agreed on the strategy and how we enable these technologies. And we're saying we need to look into that into detail for the next iteration. The detailed socio-economic impact analysis of the decommissioning of old coal-fired power plants, that would have reached the 50-year life. We also identify that as something that requires urgent attention as a department. So, and we're saying these are not necessarily the only studies. There may be other studies that members of the public or the community would want to be detailed so that they can better inform the IRP going forward. And Chair, so that's how we came with the IRP. Then from what I showed as the least cost plan, then we looked at, then we went through what we call policy adjustment. And when we looked at policy adjustment, we looked at the plan and we thought about what everybody was saying to say that first, we've got a program going from a renewable energy point of view. If you put brakes on it, I mean, all the efforts and the benefits that went behind it is likely to go to waste. And when we went into the plan, we looked at it. We looked at the plan where we had put the annual limits, and we realized that when you place the annual limits, the model still builds renewable energy. So basically, it's saying, in simple terms, it's saying it is still cheaper, even if you build renewables than to build something else, even if you impose limits. So it actually almost still fixed the same quantum within the same period. And that's what happened. That's what happens. And this is the table that you see on the right. And that's why we had also concluded that imposing annual build limits on renewables pre-2030 does not affect the amount of renewables you are likely to build by 2030. Beyond 2030, we agree it will. But we're saying that goes into the bigger discussion because we're not firming up on the post-2030 plan. We're saying there are many things. Before we can even agree what the mix looks like post-2030, there are many things that we need to discuss. And whether we're going to keep caps or you're going to remove them, we believe it's a discussion that must still happen. Chair, the second thing that we looked at was to say, are there any commitments that we are aware of that are pending that are not on this plan? And we came with, actually it was around three, but it was the fact that we had gone out on procurement of 1,000 megawatts of coal as part of the IPP program. And I think in the same manner that we were arguing previously to say we need to show commitment to investors. If we do something, we need to follow through. It was our belief that it is right that we do the same for the coal projects, the two coal projects that we had already committed to. Because, Chair, it, 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 if we don't do that, some of us believe that, then it means with any program you can go halfway. If something changes, then you can pull the plug. You know, so, and that does not show actually consistency on our side, you know, in terms of the program. So that's why then it was agreed, or it was proposed to say the 1,000 megawatts of coal, which is to make up for the already procured about 900 megawatts, must be included in the IRP as previously procured. The other one was the fact that there is a treaty between South Africa and the DRC for us to offtake 2,500 megawatts. It's work in progress, and we also said that, I mean, there is an agreement that's on the table, and we cannot just look the other way and abandon it, because then what do we mean with agreements that we sign as a country? Can we just sign agreements and then when we feel like it, we just walk away? It does not bode well for us. So, Chair, those are the two key things, but what we did, just to give comfort to everyone, we did not plug them on top of everything and assume that everything else remains the same. We allowed the model to optimize for those. So you can call it, we forced them in, and the model recalculated. And you'll see in the next table that we show, that's how you'll see that some of the things have slightly moved. The other thing that we were proposing, Chair, is that because of the changing technology landscape and the innovation that happens, was that the technologies in the plan should actually be considered a proxy. Because, and what do you mean by that? We're saying there is nothing that tells us that by 2021, 2022, someone wouldn't have come up with something that behaves like PV at the same cost as PV. So we're saying, then why can't you, when you procure, why can't you procure for a solution rather than a specific technology and allow these technologies to compete? I don't know if that that makes sense. Let me give it example of gas and storage. There is a belief that storage did not make it here because of the prices that we assumed, right? So what we're saying is, if storage can come in at the same prices that we assume for gas, because it provides you the same sort of characteristics, maybe other additional benefits, there shouldn't be a difficulty in actually at the point of procurement, because at the point of procurement, the new GenRec says that the Minister of Energy can actually ask for a feasibility study before he procures. You know, so as part of the Section 34, you can say, you know, what the solution, so you can look at various options, not just one specific option. So that's what we're saying by the statement to say we must adopt a position that says that other technologies that we are aware of, or those that we're not aware of, or those that we're aware of, the price is not good at this point in time, should actually be considered at the point when you procure. So we should not say the table said it's PV and it must be PV. We should be able to say it said it's PV because PV has got certain characteristics and it came at a specific cost. So anything that looks and costs the same should be considered. And we believe that provides the flexibility that we're talking about, to say that your plan should be able to adapt to changing assumptions. The third one, Chair, was the last one was the what we call the annual, the embedded generation. With regard to embedded generation, I mean, one of the challenges here as a department, we're sitting with a number of requests, because the regulator can only license requests in line with what's in the IRP. So basically, a lot of people that wanted to do what we call generation for own use could not do it. They first have to come to the minister for the minister to give them a letter of deviation, and only then the regulator can actually license them. And Chair, because of the changing technology that you're talking about, we've seen a huge number of these things, and it's creating backlog. So basically, we were saying by recognizing embedded generation in the IRP, you do away with the need to come to the Minister of Energy. There was a point that was made earlier, last week as well, around the number that we used. Yes, 200 we've assumed is arbitrary. There's no science behind it. We've had suggestions. Some of the suggestions are saying we must look at what we have already on the table and use that as a starting point. And I've also had a few people saying they've done studies, they've got the numbers. We're hoping that as part of the submission process, those numbers have been submitted to better guide what we're trying to do. But Chair, what we're also saying is that there's only one sort of, I'd say, demand for the country. So the reality is, while in the RP we have not discounted embedded generation from the projected demand that we're using, at the point of issuing of determinations, the department will have to take stock, because you don't want to go, you don't want, for example, if you're projecting that next year you can see 1,000 megawatts coming. If 500 megawatts happen in embedded generation, you need to take that into account, because it's the same demand you're chasing. So actually, at that point in time, you should go for 500, not 1,000, because 500 has already happened somewhere else. So while we're not in here discounting it out of the capacities that you see, but we're saying at the point of issuing a determination, some taking of stock needs to be done. Otherwise, you could actually overbuild, and ultimately the consumer pays. Chair, after everything that has been said, this table indicates capacities. In yellow is what has been committed. You'll see there's a whole lot of coal that's coming in 2019, 2020, new coal, by the way, 2021 up to 2022. That coal in yellow is the completion of Medupi and Kusile. And you can see as well there's PV, wind, and CSP, and these are the part of the up to the 27 projects that are coming in. In green is what we propose as new capacity, the 1,000 megawatt of coal, and the hydro, and the PV and wind. And then you've got gas there. So basically, just to summarize, what you are seeing, if you're sitting in 2030, and I think here I wanted to draw the distinction between installed capacity and energy, because we buy energy, we don't necessarily buy installed capacity. So if you look at installed capacity, yes, when you're sitting in 2030, it will look like coal will only constitute 47%. But because coal is base load, if you look here, coal will still contribute 64%, plus minus 65% of the energy that is produced per annum in 2030. And I think there was also a big issue around the quantum of gas. And this is what I also need to explain, to say, I think people are saying 8 gigawatts of gas. Because the gas that we have in the plan does not, it's to fill in the gaps. It comes in mostly as peaking plant and a bit of mid-merit. And you will see that in terms of the volume, it's only in terms of energy. It's while its installed capacity is 17% of the total installed. In terms of the energy produced, it will only provide 3%. You know, so I think that I'm not sure if the point I'm trying to make comes out clear, but I think when we do analysis, because we pay for energy, we don't pay, I mean, yes, there's the capacity thing, but we pay for energy, we pay for the megawatts, so it's about the volume. You know, from you can look at it as, if you look at it as rands and cents, 64% of the 1 rand, 64 cents of the 1 rand will go to the coal industry, only 3 cents will go to gas. And only 8 cents will go to, I think nuclear is about, it will still be about 8% of the mix that is available there. So, Chair, I this is the end of my presentation. I had additional slides, but these ones here was to, because my modeling colleagues were not happy with some of the comments that were made last week, because they seemed to, there was a suggestion that we take results or we take models from CSIR and then we run with them without necessarily thinking about them. And Chair, I think this one here, my modeling colleagues felt that I need to indicate that, I mean, the modeling team that we use, I mean, as a team, they have over 20 years of experience together and combined 60 years in energy planning and all that. And they are also professionals. They are engineers and they are scientists and they are mathematicians. So in their own right, they would not necessarily be taking stuff from somewhere and just running with it, even if they were given that. There was an issue around the tool. The tool that we use is Plexos. It's Australian-developed production and capacity expansion tool. This tool has been used by the modeling team since 2009. This tool is also, by the way, used by Eskom system operator for plant scheduling. I mean, I took some of the, I won't mention the name, but there's one of the bodies, maybe I should say. I mean, we went with Nexa and NIASA, where to system ops, where actually we spent time there, and they showed them, and I mean, even the accuracy of how they get the scheduling done using the very same tool. So where we're sitting, there is no doubt about the ability of the tool to do the work, and it's used globally as indicated there, and locally it's used by those parties that indicated there. But Chair, just to also emphasize that the input that we put in the model, we actually shared the model with three parties. We shared it with CSIR, we shared it with NREL, which is US-based. We also shared it with the developers of the tool to tell us if the data we've put into the model has been inputted correctly so that the output is not necessarily questionable. So we had gone through that. And this share we did because at the time, there was a question around the fact that the modeling team that we used is sitting in ESCO. So how do we know that, you know, when you are sleeping, they don't go and and change the tool. So this was to give comfort even to the department. And we are comfortable to say that others have looked at what went into the model. I'm not going to go into this one yet. This was more for the engineers who were questioning the cost and how the model treats some of the cost. Chair, I will stop at this and take any question.
So this is the sixth day, day number six. Yeah, no wonder my mind feels so exhausted. Okay, thanks, DG and DDG. So you'll see that the DOE, what we tried to do was to give context, show the rationale and the things they're putting in the draft, and to respond to some of the questions some of the issues that were raised over the last 5 days of the hearings. So from where they stand, they say between now and 2030, everything considered, all the contending views, this is the best we can put forward for the country. I want to hear those who say you are wrong. So I'm not going to go in a particular order. There may be people who want to ask questions or who want to comment on what has been presented. So I'm going to note hands and then just please introduce yourselves. I'll see how we go about this depending on the amount of comments or questions put forward. I'll allow them to immediately respond so that we can try and conclude on each of the issues that were raised. They've covered a lot of the things that were raised. The parliamentary staff has a long list of the issues that arose out of the public hearings. So we will see by the time we finish whether we would have responded and clarified all of those ones. So I want to take hands. Now, Esther, you want to speak now? No. Okay. Don't put me into trouble. I'll come to you, honorable members. Can I start with you, or I come to you later on, so that you can apply your minds as the comment. Because you are not the other stakeholders. Sir, let's start with you. I think you are from some organization that I don't like. So,
Chair, I'm sure you will change your mind about that as we proceed. I want to compliment the department on telescoping in on the CRISP issues, and also I'm very encouraged by the degree to which it's open for further engagement and consideration, and we certainly will do our best to satisfy your willingness to gain, and we will learn from you as well as we've done. So thank you for that, and it's a very sincere compliment. That's not just trying to be polite. The three big issues, as far as it seems to me, is firstly the huge departure, almost 180-degree reversal of the 2010-2030 RP tells one how much uncertainty there is. This is really the most important lesson to learn from that, is to be humble about what, and you were, and you said you might shorten the period, and that I think is a correct response to the problems of uncertainty and not knowing the future. But it does also say be very, very humble about the assumptions, and you've quite correctly said you gained them from other sources and what they were, and you're willing to consider countervailing evidence. That's very good. A lot of what you said was about filling the gap or the purpose of gas, and since you're procuring, or at least you want Eskom to procure, the fundamental question is, why is that your business? In other words, why not simply let Eskom procure full dispatchable energy, and those who supply it must see to it that it's regular, and they must provide the gas or the batteries or whatever it is. In other words, Eskom simply, and we've used the term liberate Eskom from having to fill the gaps where suppliers are unable to do so. In other words, simply let Eskom buy reliable, fully dispatchable energy and not have to go into complex, uncertain future exercises which can't be done. Simply not possible for Eskom to know what it's going to cost in the future. Let the investor decide that. Let the person who is the procurer decide that. And let them take the risk. So if they insist that gas can fill the gaps or batteries can fill the gaps, let them do it. Let them invest the money. Let them put the money where their mouth is. That should not be Eskom's responsibility and should not, if I may say, be your responsibility in the department. So Eskom just be freed to go out and procure power that it wants. And it should not be any of Eskom's business what to happen when the power fails. It must be reliable and dependable. The next thing is, given the uncertainty from IRP 2010-2030, which you've acknowledged, and that's very, very important, one should certainly in the future have a balance. We should not think we know what the future is going to be. We should be very humble and say we know that in the future we as a country want a balanced investment, as opposed to the last table you showed, I have it before me, which is essentially almost 100% investment in wind and solar. there should be a continuing balanced investment in energy sources in the knowledge that we have no idea now which one in the future is going to turn out to have been the lowest cost or the best investment. We don't look at what appears to be the lowest cost now, and we can debate whether that calculation is correct. We would like to debate that. But nonetheless, assuming you reach a conclusion, one has to be humble and say, we may be wrong. So we will certainly try to persuade you that there can be improvements in that calculation. But even if we can't, we could be wrong and you could be wrong. And that humility about the future is really what it seems to us is lacking in the IRP, and you've acknowledged that. So if I might say, I think we're essentially on the same page. So, Chair, even if you don't like our organization, maybe the department might end up doing so. Thank you, Chair. My apology, Tay. I'm Leon Lowe from the Truth in Energy project, and I also happen to be from the Free Market Foundation, which is the organization to which I think you were referring, but that's not who I'm representing here today. This is Truth in Energy, and if I may say, our paradigm or our philosophy is, as the name implies, just get it right, get the facts right. We're not biased in favor of any one or other kind of energy. We think the bias maybe against nuclear is misplaced. It should be much more firmly in the mix. Coal, the bias against coal is misplaced.
I didn't ask you to make a second round.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much. I may not like your organization, but I think I like your views. You are next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Andrew Kenny. I'm an engineer, and I'm also a member of the Truth in Energy campaign. Unfortunately, we don't think as one. We've got our individual views with the same end in mind. I've got two big disagreements with the IRP 2018. The first is over demand. What the IRP assumes is that we're going to have very, very low demand, which is associated with economic stagnation, with catastrophically high unemployment, and with lack of industrialization, lack of beneficiation, lack of manufacturing, which has been the case, unfortunately, in recent years for all sorts of reasons and failures. If you have a look at the past, when South Africa was successful, when we were industrial or partially successful, when we were industrializing, we were manufacturing, unemployment was much lower than now. In those years, under Dr. Verwoerd, under an apartheid dictator who was only serving a section of the country, we had at times 6%, 7% economic growth and 10% electricity growth. This is under an apartheid dictator. Are you saying that under democracy, serving all of the people, we can't do better? Of course we can do better. And what we should be planning or lying out for, lying to happen, is high economic growth, mopping up our disastrous unemployment, industrialization, benefiting our raw materials, not sending them to China to be having value added to them, and greatly increasing our manufacturing. We should be planning on economic demand and electricity growth demand of 5% at least, allowing for enough electricity capacity so that if that happens, we're ready to use it. The even bigger argument, I'm afraid, is on least cost. Dr. Mbeli explained it very well. I thought he gave a very good definition of it, and that's exactly what I would want by least cost. I'm sorry, have I got the name right? No, I've called everybody doctor unless I know otherwise. If they've got grey hair, I call them professor. But since you haven't got any hair at all, I call you doctor. very fashionable, or five gentlemen are in fashion. Okay, but what you give as the least cost solution is in fact the greatest cost of all, which is winds and solar PV. Now, it's been shown in the real world, not in the virtual world of energy modeling, in the real world, this is the most expensive combination you can possibly get. And you look all around the world, in Germany, in England, in southern Australia, in the United States, wherever you go, the more winds and PV they have on the grid, the higher the price of electricity to the final user. So in Germany, they're phasing out nuclear, turning heavily to solar and wind, and the result is electricity prices go up and up and up. And as they're going up, you're reading day by day, ooh, it's amazing how PV prices are coming down. As you're reading that, you hear that in Germany the prices to the final user are going up. The reason why these are so expensive and the reason why the models is completely wrong is because they don't allow for the system cost. You've got a very unreliable source of electricity with PV and wind. There is a graph, an actual graph of our REIPPPP. This is the actual production of this electricity, and it's a nightmare. Up and down and wild fluctuations, completely unpredictable. In southern Australia, they implemented this plan. They implemented the least cost plan, and the result was electricity prices soared. At one stage, reaching 140 rand a kilowatt hour, this is in July 2016, a price of 150 times more than Eskom's selling price at one stage, with their least cost solution. The reason is the system cost. Because it's so fluctuating, it imposes enormous costs on the system operator, which is Eskom in this case. They've got to have standby generation, they've got to have backup generation, they've had extra capacity to meet this unreliable solar and wind. They've got that extra transmission line, they've got a spinning reserve. All of this is very, very, very expensive. So even if the price of PV and wind to Eskom was 20 cents a kilowatt hour, very cheap, the final costs would still be very, very high. And my calculations show that the most affordable energy, and I'm speaking to a lady this morning, I think it's morally important to have affordable electricity for everybody. And the most affordable electricity is nuclear, based on experience all around the world. Thank you.
This doesn't mean anything with regard to the other points people are making. We had a second point Mr. Lowe was making. You heard that? You see, I want to see what goes into the IRP. So every time you speak, I'm trying to think. So how does this fit? If someone hopes now that we're going to have a scenario that dismantles everything, I think we're going to cause so much havoc that Department of Energy is going to say, but please, you can't be serious. So I think we must be clear what we're trying to do. And there are some inputs that I can see that are quite helpful in trying to help the draft IRP be a better document. So the engineer next to you is there, you see, you can't repeat the things you said last week. So, for instance, when you say they've run a model, so then you say that, okay, nuclear is the cheapest technology, but you don't explain how in the 5 years, in the 12 years, in the period ending 2030, and in the modeling they have done, how that would form part of what they're pursuing as a least cost model. So you're not showing us that. So, and then we, because we can debate, because I asked them, why is it not there? They say, they told me something about scalability. So I didn't know what that is. I said, no, you see, we've been told, you, if you could just put 500 megawatts of it, maybe we would. But we've been told we can't. So we can't. So remember I said, please, man, no rallies now. It's too late for me. We're trying to get to a point where we can get to finalizing a report. So I'm not saying don't express your views, but just keep in mind what's in the IRP and how we trying to take it forward. So I've heard you. So you can come back later on. So, because you see, if somebody else is going to repeat, coal is very important, our people, this in Mpumalanga, that thing does not help in sorting out the challenges we have with the model in putting that as part of the mix in the RP. It's good. You can stand, you can go to some stadium and say that, so it's perfect. But it's not helping us here try resolve the difficulties we have in trying to produce a better document. Okay, who's next? Prof, are you back? Today I'm not very polite. So if you say something that I think you shouldn't be telling your students, I'm going to stop you and say, Prof, you can't seriously be teaching students such things. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would never suggest something to you that I wasn't prepared to teach my students. The DG and DDG referred to the need for a robust debate, and I think that one of the greatest weaknesses of this IRP is the same weakness that was evident in the 2016 and in the 2010 versions, and I criticized them at the time. The load forecast is unbelievable. It will not happen. In the short term, there is no possibility that our electricity demand is going to grow by the 4 or 5 or 6% that you're projecting for this year and for next year. In the short term, this projection is not possible. In the longer term, the high projection is higher than has ever been sustained for any period in South Africa. It would be a remarkable economic achievement to reach that kind of growth, particularly as you pointed out that the energy intensity of the economy has reduced. In the long term, the highest forecast on which you've based your scenarios is not possible. At the other end of the forecast, you are not taking into account the energy projection that you defended in your explanation as being a result of energy efficiency and all those other good things. you don't have any flatline energy projection. We've been decreasing for 10 years. An improvement to a flat line is what I would recommend you take as your low projection. In the same way that I don't think the high projection is possible, I would like to think that a complete collapse below a flat line, I hope, will not be allowed to be possible. So I would suggest that between the two extremes of the low projection and a high projection within a feasible limit of growth, there is a middle path. And that opens up a cone in the long term, which is modified by the reality of the short term as we grow out of 1% growth. I think that a robust debate on things like the load forecast is probably essential, because the whole of the rest of the plan is based on that, on meeting the energy forecast requirements. And I think that because it is the foundation, and it's very difficult to build a house on a bad foundation, I think that you need to fix the foundation first. And I think that there are many people who would be prepared to contribute to that robust debate about what the scenarios are, and maybe they're infinite, but for planning purposes, I suggest you choose a feasible low, a feasible high, and a middle path. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, I'm reminded I didn't introduce myself. I'm Trevor Gorn from the University of Cape Town Department of Electrical Engineering. I apologize.
It is because you believe professors don't have to introduce themselves. Who's next? I thought, okay. I'm going to come this side because you are shy to raise your hand. Oh, no. I'll come there to you. I think the gentleman there
thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the members and colleagues. I think my first point would be to congratulate the DOE on the plan, DG and Minister and colleagues. But also I would like, as SALCA, because we are 40% of the demand, to also make a point around the forecasting. Chair, we need to give DOE an opportunity to explain maybe why is DOE adamant on keeping with the forecast that they have in the plan, while I think a lot of stakeholders have been raising the issue around demand. I think from our side as local government is mostly to make a point around what is really happening at that point in time. Because in the RP, I think the load forecast or the demand forecast is mostly aligned with what is the forecast or the demand forecast of Eskom. But I think, as I said in our presentation, that might not be really accurate, because as a lot of things that are happening, we might say we have put embedded generation as part of being progressive in the plan because it's what is happening at distribution level, but we might not even be able to control it because the regulation allows for people to build their own for own consumption, which means you might see a lot of dynamics happening there for bigger companies and malls and industries building their own generation for own use, which they don't even want to put back into the system of municipalities. So the point I'm trying to make is let's try, because I see now that the DOE is open to the regular reviews of the RP. Let's try and involve the key stakeholders in the cake of the demand and get the realistic data from them. What are you envisaging in the next few years? What is happening right now? And I think I did say that as local government, we can give that kind of data, especially from metros, who are 65 to 70% of all municipalities in terms of the consumption and the demand. They can actually give a picture around what is happening with the growth in the consumption of electricity, what is happening with regards to the economic growth within those municipalities. So I think my suggestion also, over and above, for DoDE to explain why are they adamant to keep this optimistic forecast, but also let's try in these regular reviews to include all the key stakeholders that are actually, you know, claiming the bigger cake of the demand. And I'm talking mining, I'm talking local government, and I'm talking other stakeholders. It's a few of them that could actually make, you know, inputs with the data that is, you know, more realistic for the more accurate load forecast. I think also I wanted to, because we did raise, I think Jacob talked about people who were raising issues around the cost of battery. I think also Salka did raise that. The studies have shown that by 2030, 70%, the price of battery will be reduced by 70%, and that was not affected in the plan. But I think I was a bit comfortable with what my colleague said from DOE. He said we must procure, what did you say? You know, procure technology, procure the solution. So at that point in time when battery is actually reducing substantially, then it means there's that flexibility in the plan to start reviewing and say, okay, now maybe we don't need this much gas. We can affect the battery storage because of the price effect of it. So I think that sort of responded to some of our concerns around the battery as well. Lastly, I think I'm going to talk about embedded generation, which is what hits the municipalities the most. I'm just cautioning the department around this one. First, we did say that let's do more studies around what are the realistic figures, because I think DOE also was very honest that the figures were arbitrary. So let's do more studies. We are happy to help with more studies around what is realistic on embedded generation, but I want to caution around when we do determination in the implementation, just to control and not collapse the distribution industry. Because the 200 megawatts a year up until 2030, it's actually just for anyone. It doesn't say this is for municipalities, this is for private sector, this is for customers, so it's just for anyone. So in order for us to have control around not collapsing the distribution sector, we should have those allocations within, you know, the allocations that are on the embedded generation. So the example I'm making, out of the 200 megawatts, if you open it up, obviously private sector would have more financial muscle than municipalities, and they'll be quicker to eat the whole cake. So what I'm trying to say as a suggestion, maybe allocate some megawatts within that cake, that this is purely for municipalities, and then the rest. So that was just our suggestion. And thank you, Chair, again for the opportunity.
It's too much for you. Oh, you still up? You want to respond now? Oh, okay. No, I thought he wants to take more questions. The more questions he has, the more he can dodge. Okay, no. Respond now.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start. I think the points from Mr. Lowe, more comments that we've taken. There were less questions. The main issue I picked up from Mr. Kenny was around demand, which I think Professor Gond went the other way, Chair. And I think from where we sit, our view, and I think we tried to capture it as well in the opening remarks of the DG, our view is that we can sit here and debate the demand projection. I can tell you that we'll all get it wrong. because no one has got the crystal ball for the future. I think the point that we're making around how flexible, what is important is how flexible is your solution to reacting to the changing assumptions. And if you look at the plan and the timing, I think you spoke about scalability or modularity. If you look at where technology is going, technology is becoming so modular that it allows you to actually respond in incremental ways rather than in big blocks where actually you are locked in into a decision and you are unable to move. So, Chair, while we take the points around demand and the suggestions which we'll engage further with the parties that have made them, I think our view is that the reality is that there'll always be various departing points. The view that we've taken was more a scientific approach because, I mean, the statisticians that we worked with, obviously, they use stats to project on demand. And we possibly could be wrong, you know, but what we also noted is that, anyways, the biggest driver of new capacity, even just during that period, is actually decommissioning, because you'll see that when you come out of the 2020s, you almost build in nothing because you're completing the existing projects. It's only towards the end. And if you look at the graph of decommissioning, you'll see that towards the end, in towards 2030, that's when you're actually decommissioning the chunk of the 12 gigawatts that's projected for decommissioning. And that's what mainly drives the new capacity at that point. You know, so in terms of capacity, we do take the point. We can go engage the other parties and look at it, but we believe that it will not necessarily change the picture that much. But we also believe that because if you take stock at any point in time before you issue a determination, because the IRP is an indication, at the point you issue a determination, ministerial determination, obviously we're supposed to take stock in terms of what's reality on the ground, and that is supposed to guide what we're doing. The points from SALGA, they were indicating that, I think, Chair, there I need to first respond to the point that Nandla made around the assumption is that demand is captive to ESCOM. I think we've accepted that. When you project demand, you project electricity demand. We don't take a view as to where the demand is going to go. And yes, when we do the study, the assumption is that we're saying at grid scale, what will be the cheapest form of addressing that solution? So that's what you see in the plan. But we're saying we are alive to the fact that there is embedded generation, there is generation at local level that is happening. And hence we said, at the point where we issue the determination, we also need to take stock of what has happened. And that's why we're working with the regulator. I mean, for example, for plants, for embedded generation under 1 megawatts, we're asking that those plants get registered. Because then once they get registered, at any point in time, you have a view of how many of those plants have been constructed. You've got a sense of the capacity that is out there. So it's not, I think it's incorrect to assume that the capacity that sits in there is for ESCOM. It is only at the point that the ministerial it's for ESCOM, and even it's for IPPs, because it's only at the point where the Minister of Energy issues a Section 34, where he determines who the buyer is, who procures, who is the buyer, you know, in that setup. So where I'm sitting, and obviously it's obviously up to the Minister of Energy, I mean, it can be ESCOM, it can be municipalities, it can be the IPPs. So the IRP does not take a view. The IRP just looks at the energy needs, and all it does is that its departure point is that you only pay for the energy at the point where the energy comes out, which is generally the IPP model. But there is nothing that stops ESCOM and municipalities to actually do projects in that fashion. So the capacity is the demand in there. It's not, it's adamant because it's ESCOM, we're ignoring the fact that things are happening on the ground. It's capacity as we see it in the electricity sector, and it could be coming from either embedded generation or grid scale type of generation, Chair.
Which inputs you want to respond to?
Okay, I might have missed some, but I thought I dealt at high level with the ones that I've picked up. Which one did I miss, Chair? No, I did acknowledge that we will, I mean, the Prof has, I've heard him offering to engage more and assist in looking at the forecast, and we'll take him on that. Obviously, together with the people that assist us to put the forecast together.
The hands this side? Can I see all the hands this side? I need to increase speed. You'll be first. Can I see more hands? Second, third, three. Quiet.
Thank you. My name is Khaupalil Sansweri. I'm here as a rep of the Nuclear Industry Association. Chair, I just want to make inputs to that to say that for the plan to work for the country, we need to consider the following. Because the plan suggests a transition. I mean, retiring 12,000 megawatts of coal or 10,000, that's a lot of numbers in terms of the economy of scale. I mean, we've got a lot of people employed, we've got a lot of other issues that you need to consider when you retire that. And we've looked into the, I think they call the Independent Power Producer Procurement Program, which was a document that was an overview of the 31st of March 2018. Which says that the program up to thus far has created about 85,702 job years. I mean, to the note that we received is that the job year, for me, is, as an example, having worked in the nuclear industry for 10 years, that will be 10 job years. Now, taking the number of the retirement of those coal power stations, we need to find the balancing to say that what is it that we can propose to fill that gap, because I've heard that the gap is also created on a system, but also the gap is created through the economy. Now, 2030, that's where we'll start seeing a lot of new generation coming as per the presentation from DOE. And we've seen that some of these mega projects takes between 7 to 10 years. So for you to look into that, the RPs will also take into consideration that we need to have mega projects, let's say base load, to fill the gap that is created by retiring those power stations in order to ensure that we augment the economy, because the economy will be impacted in terms of when you retire, you are not only doing that. I mean, if a plant has worked for 60 years, you typically have between 2.5 to 3 generation working there. So if it's 3 generation, that is probably, you will take 3 multiplied by 60, that gives you 180 job years. So what we're proposing is that we need to factor those things into the IRP so that it does not only respond to the cheapest cost of producing electricity, but it also responds to the cost as a function of benefit, that the cost of investment must also reflect on the benefit that will go into the economy to ensure that our economy does not go on a depreciating mode as it continuously does. So that bearing in mind is that we propose that because Grootfontein has already gotten an environmental authorization, which millions of money has been spent already at Grootfontein. So Eskom has lost money. So if you continue losing that without actually factoring it to say, how do we beneficiate? Because there's already a gap. We can extend to say that we can have an extension of Quebec on the very side that has already been authorized without leaving that investment going to waste. So that is point number one that you need to also consider when we draft the plan. The other issue is that when you're doing that, it will also be imperative that the department look through, because it says within that document that the request for or the competitive bidding process of renewable has actually assisted the department in bringing down the cost. So we've seen there's been a lot of development within the nuclear space. Power stations have come online on time and on schedule. It's there on the record. We've seen that. I think the next 2 years, we'll see 24 gigawatts of nuclear being coming online as since the couple of years. So if you subject the very same process to a nuclear technology based on the development that are currently happening, we will get the true cost of exactly how much will cost the nuclear power station. Because now, when you issue a request, you will get competitors giving you information that they cannot put on a public platform to say that someone can come in there and do a desktop study and have an idea. Because remember, that is not only based on the price. There are other factors that competitors will want to take advantage of in order to ensure that they get a, they give you a better deal. So when we were looking at that, we said that we are proposing that the energy mix look into those other factors as to ensure that when we progress, because it will drive the narrative of saying that the benefit also is a factor that we're considering, not only just the cost or the price of that. Because when I look at the argument that was brought forward, it's like that gas must be expensive, but because we are looking at its flexibility, hence it was thought to be put into the IRP. So looking at the socioeconomic impact of having a nuclear build program, that should be put into effect also to say we need to consider that. So we already have a site that is licensed to a certain megawatt. So when you talk of scale and pace, that is where the scale and pace come into effect. To say that if that is authorized for 4,000 megawatt, so the scale and pace is how much will cost 2 units. Can we put cost 2 units as also part of replacing the 10 or 12,000 megawatt that we are losing by retiring old coal power stations? So I wanted to put these things to say that we might have to look into it as a fact, because from the report it says that construction lead time for 3,700 megawatt of that was roughly 1.9 years or 686. So an economy of 7 to 10 years, it talks volume. So those are the things that we want to propose forward to say that probably the plan, we need to get the true cost of what, how much is nuclear from the market, not on just a desktop study, and input into that to say that the scale and pace, we already have said that Eskom has spent millions of rands to get it authorized. So let's move. This is what we are proposing moving forward as a solution. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, before the lady there and the gentleman, Mr. Mello, do you want to respond to this?
Yes, Chair. I think, Chair, maybe not necessarily, maybe the point, one of the points that I should have made is that I think in the context of, again, for me, I start at demand point. In the context of demand, we, when we look at the volumes in terms of demand, we are sitting at the levels of today, if not before 2007, at the levels of 2007 in terms of the energy demand. We were hoping to be 30% or so in 2018, more than what we had in 2010, and that has not materialized. And in the same period, we've actually procured 18,000 megawatts of new capacity, consisting of Medupi, Kusile, Ingula, and renewables. So in that, in the context of demand that did not materialize, and decommissioning that's going to happen, what you are seeing is that some of the decommissioning gap, and that's why you see the capacity coming towards the latter part of the 2030s, not initially. And so, Chair, in terms of from a demand and supply point of view, that's the context that I can give. But the other thing is, it's less maybe a response, but it's a question, because one of the assumptions that we make, I think we spoke about, for example, if you take coal, I mean, coal projects as an example, we come from an era where they used to come in six packs, right? I mean, 4,600 megawatts. We've moved into an era where actually now you can go and do a 300 megawatts or a 600 megawatt coal plant, then it's economical. As we model currently in the IRP, and it's something that perhaps maybe the colleagues can assist with, is that we've been informed, or we understand that for a nuclear, we model it as a fleet, and in the form of 2 units of about, let's say, plus minus about 3,000 megawatts, and it is our understanding that it is in pairs like that the project becomes economical. You know, and so there is this thing about scale and how you deploy the technology in terms of the modularity. So I think it's a discussion that we need to have. you know, because the point you're making about finding space for it, it's what I'm hearing from how I understand the nuclear projects happening is finding space for 3,000 megawatts, for, you know, if I use 1,500 as a unit size. So, Che, that's one of the complexities in terms of, if you look at especially the space that you're looking at, is that it comes in bigger sizes compared to the other technologies, and that's where, even if it's cheaper, but in a short sort of space of time, it becomes the most expensive type of technology. But maybe there is a specific or detailed suggestion that the colleagues would want to make, and we're more than willing to engage them and understand.
Ma'am?
Thank you, Chair. I am Liz McDade from the Southern African Faith Communities Environment Institute. So my understanding of today is that we are here to give some clarity and particularly some questions to the DOE. So I've sort of looked at what we've, in addition to what we've heard. So, and I'll try not to repeat some of the things that have already been said, which we might agree with. And I think, Chair, maybe I'm being cheeky, but we've already had two persons from the nuclear industry response, and there's only one from speaker from the faith community. Do I get a longer time, or do I get two bites to make it fair? But maybe that's not necessary. Just to say that we also had concerns around the demand, and particularly if I go back to 2010 and how the demand was calculated. Now, if I remember then, the way it was done on the sectoral totals aggregated, which is what is the similar wording which appears in this IRP, was that, for example, Eskom was asked to go to its particular customers and ask them what they thought they would need in terms of the future, and then that was aggregated. And in that particular process, the point from Salga was raised even in 2010 that this does not necessarily materialize. So my clarity question was, how did you actually come up, when it says sectoral totals were aggregated, who provided those sectoral things? And so then how did you take into account the municipal section of it, which basically wasn't growing? So just to try and understand that a bit more. So then the other question is, if we are going to only produce, if we're going to limit the renewables in order to bring them forward, and you've said nothing really changes up to 2030, do we in any way inhibit a localization strategy post-2030? Are there any implications for that, because that would have an impact on jobs. And obviously, when we look at the price path, which I don't think you presented, it seems that the least cost model is the renewables going forward. And our view is least cost energy can then become an enabler for other sectors of the economy. So it's not necessarily that we have to create all the jobs inside the energy sector. The idea is if you have cheapest energy, it provides an enabler for other parts of the industry. Although we are slightly concerned about some smelter was going to leave because electricity was expensive, but what about all of us who can't leave? So then simply to just raise the decommissioning and the nuclear cost. So just to add into that, and we have provided some details, but just maybe to highlight, was the cost of finance included in the capital cost of nuclear in your model? And then maybe also to share that in the tender that did go out in 2008 for nuclear vendors, the amounts, according to the information we have, were around $6,000 per kilowatt. And if you just put a little bit of inflation into that, that would give us $8,200 today. So we would wonder why the IOP is coming up with the 3,700 per kilowatt. So maybe just some clarity about that. And if we had to add financing costs, that should make another 50%. And the only thing that we can see when we look at that cost is that those are the models that come without safety features that are regarded as important. So again, we would like to be sure that we are not going to be potentially going for a nuclear plant that doesn't have the best safety features. We wouldn't want to be dumped on again as Africa. And then I think in terms of another question for the department is if we can decommission the older coal plants earlier, does that not also give us an opportunity to bring in maybe more renewables, clean up the electricity fleet, and therefore have an improved health for the people of Mpumalanga, for which we have the lights on here and they are coughing and spluttering. So, you know, trying to bear in mind that we want the least cost, but we also want to try and bring some relief to those who are currently suffering. And I would just like to put a proviso in there that I think just transition doesn't mean that you are retrenching coal workers. It means we need a plan for that. I'm just not so sure it's the Department of Energy's job to come up with that. Maybe it's economic development, labor, but people should not be without jobs because of it. The just energy transition should ensure that all have jobs. So I think those are some of our questions which might help us going forward.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Member Ms. Faku and Mama Lesa, for giving us this opportunity to address you as members of this portfolio committee, and also obviously for having the Department of Energy here to hear not what we said last week, but rather to ask some questions about your positioning now. And it is interesting that in the 1990s we met with members such as yourself in the streets discussing policy. In the 2000s, communities came to Parliament, protested. I remember even a protest placard saying, "In Parliament, Cecil kills." I don't know if the Honourable Malema has changed that for us, but that is the sad situation, that people are not, you know, in Parliament with vigorous voices. So we have these very quiet parliamentary meetings with some poker faces sitting opposite me, trying to figure out what am I going to say next. So I'm a bit confused by this, and I really asked the Department of Energy to go out to Mpumalanga, to go out to Newcastle, to go out to South Durban, to go out to the Vaal Environmental Spaces where the Vaal Environmental Justice Alliance is working in Sasselburg, and to speak to people there so that they can understand what you're thinking of in terms of energy going forward. So that is really important. For groundwork, if we don't get that consultation right through the Department of Energy, these spaces are meaningless. You know, the majority of the portfolio committee people are not here. So how are we going to, or how are you going to make a collective decision going forward? This is of concern to groundwork. And just to say, we are not the community, but just an NGO called Groundwork. I have with me today the Public Health Association of South Africa, James Earlham, as well as the Center for Environmental Rights, who we work with closely. And as the nuclear industry spoke twice, I'm hoping that the floor will be open for other people to also ask questions. I
I want to raise a question about externalities to the Department of Environmental, Department of Energy. And I don't think the externalities have been considered in a meaningful way. And so I was hoping that in this discussion today there would be some reflection on what we submitted last week to show that the way the externalities have been included in your process, in your modeling, firstly excludes CO2 externalities because you don't have a constraint on CO2. There is no constraint on CO2. The figures you show here are the upper level of the peak plateau and demand and the budgets, and yet presently your emissions are way, way lower than that. So we're not reducing energy CO2 going forward. So the way the externalities were then set up for CO2 doesn't work. The way it is set up for the other chemicals says that people in South Africa, our lives are not as valuable as Europeans, and you need to change that. I mean, I've just heard today that the Minister of Finance, our new minister, is even talking about externalities. And if we start talking about externalities in a meaningful way, we will start understanding the cost of any energy sector, including renewables. Renewables are not clean. Let's not be 100. Let's not just say, ooh, beautiful renewables. They come with mining, we know. But we have to assess the externalities of all, and that is really critical. And then the debate in terms of the Department of Energy responding to the fact that we've got the surplus energy, and therefore we have to release it at cost, and I'm hoping not at cost and below, to industries, because else they will leave. They will go somewhere else. We must remember that it was these big energy-intensive industries that demanded you build Medupi and demanded you build Kusile because they needed base load. You did not build Kusile and Medupi to give people energy access. Now that this energy is coming online, billions of dollars more than it was originally planned for, those big industries that are demanding, that demanded that energy, are saying we're not paying for it. And what are they going to do? They're going to start getting embedded in energy. So now you're caught in a catch-22, because those that demanded this massive expense on coal-fired power stations are saying, if you don't give it to us below cost, we're going to do embedded energy. And now the department and Eskom's in a tight squeeze. So we really need to think of how you get out of that challenge. And let us remember, for those that speak about jobs, and I can't understand, and I don't have these figures in front of me, I can only go to Stats South Africa. We're presently sitting at a 37% unemployment rate. That's with coal, that's with nuclear, and that's with Eskom's processes. Do not tell me by digging more coal out, the people of Dalmas are going to get more jobs, because they're not. As the coal is increasing around them, the jobs are dropping. So I think there's a bit of a challenge there when we speak about jobs. We have to get these jobs figures right. We cannot just ignore that. And then finally, Chair, I would just like to add three more things for the Department of Energy to consider. A fact sheet on the myths of clean coal. I think the Department of Energy needs to look at this in terms of how they deal with coal. A fact sheet on externalities. And finally, I would also like to just submit the issues around governance to the Department of Energy, which we call broken promises, to highlight that the Department of Energy also has to look at the governance processes around these different energy choices. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that the last?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. thank you, Chair. It says Willie Majola from Eskom. I'm going to be brief. From my side, I'd just like to highlight maybe one point from one of the slides. I know we've been talking about least cost, and Eskom does support least cost for the supply, but also as well security of supply as well. And in one of the slides from DOE, they did talk about security, least cost, water, and reduction of carbon emissions. But for my purposes here, I would just like to stick to the two, the least cost and the security. I think it's true that the model, what it does, it looks at all the combinations of technologies, and it has come up with the least cost. But it does involve gas, and we have to import the gas at this stage, because I'm aware that, for instance, in the Karoo, the shale gas, the exploration has stopped. People like Shell are no longer exploring. But it does bring the security of supply into the equation. We need to assess the risks of importing the gas. Look, the model is right from a least cost perspective, but we need to do more. I think our own experience at Eskom, for instance, with the coal, is that if you've got a coal mine here, and then conveyor belt and the power station, you know, from a point of view of security of supply, that is the most advisable approach. But once you start, and maybe preferably after that, if you can transport it by rail. But when you are transporting coal by road, even in South Africa, it introduces all sorts of other dynamics as well. That from a risk point of view, from a security point of view, needs to be taken into consideration. So, to be short then, we do support the least cost approach, but because our least cost in this case involves imported gas, let us do more studies when we come out with the final draft of the IRP in terms of what are the risks that could be associated with imported gas.
Good afternoon. My name is James Earlham. I represent the Public Health Association of South Africa, the Special Interest Group on Climate, Energy and Health. When I gave a presentation here last week, I made three main points relating to the fact that energy is a major public health issue in terms of the pollution of air and water and soil. That it's also a key driver of climate change through greenhouse gas emissions, and that therefore a just energy transition is required, and the exclusion of new coal capacity in the IRP we see as a huge opportunity not only to improve public health but to also mitigate climate change. And I think it's significant that these hearings are happening in the same month that the IPCC has released its latest report showing how essential and urgent it is that global climate change, that warming above pre-industrial levels is limited to 1.5 degrees, and that a shift to renewable energy and sustainable transport is a key part of that. And it's also significant that as we are meeting here, the World Health Organization is convening the first global conference on air pollution and health in recognition of the fact that one in seven deaths, at least worldwide, are caused by air pollution, that over 90% of the world population is living in areas where the air quality is poor. And also the release of the Greenpeace report this week showing the Mpumalanga area as being one of those hotspots of air pollution and the impact that is having also on residents of Pretoria and Johannesburg. So on behalf of the Public Health Association and the Climate, Energy and Health Special Interest Group, we lend our voice to calls to support the just energy transition, to say that this is a golden opportunity that we cannot afford to let go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are no more hands. Bishop, it's not time to pray yet. Okay. Do you want to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very, very briefly, I mean, it really follows on what James Earlham has just been saying, and it's the cost of externalities. And I really hope and pray that the DOE can take into account the urgent need to reduce our carbon emissions. Right now, we have wildfires raging in South Africa. We've had global wildfires in California and Greece. Has the DOE taken into account the costs of environmental factors, including the rising oceans, when we're talking about nuclear? So I'm just really wanting to put forward the perspective of looking at our energy policy in the light of environmental impacts and the well-being of people. So it's not just the cheapest, but what is best for people and planet. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair. It's Dr. Clinton Carter-Brown from the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. With myself as Jared Wright, I head energy research at the CSIR. We've done a very extensive analysis of the IRP. And I'd just like to make a couple comments and then ask some questions. I think firstly, to compliment the DOE for including a least cost scenario in the electricity mix, that's a fundamental improvement and change in terms of the draft compared to earlier iterations. I think furthermore, just to stress, a number of views have been expressed, but our own techno-economic modeling confirms that all of the scenarios that have been presented by the DOE are technically feasible, and that the power system will be able to operate it with sufficient levels of reserves, and that analysis and modeling is looking at the entire system level cost. So fundamentally, what is being proposed by the department is all technically and economically viable. I think really then to confirm the department's own outcomes is that a future energy system consisting of a combination of renewable energy complemented with flexibility such as gas and energy storage systems is going to result in the cheapest electricity with the lowest carbon emissions and the lowest water usage. So once again, just confirming that future energy mix, as is reflected in the DOE's own IRP1 scenario, is a least cost solution that essentially has little cost trade-off in terms of the decisions that need to be made in terms of that plan. A lot of discussion being had on the load forecast. I really just want to support what the department has said in that the main driver behind the capacity new build plan out to 2030 is not so much the forecast. While the forecast is very important input, the major drivers are actually around the coal decommissioning and the schedule of the decommissioning of the Eskom fleet, and very importantly, the performance of the Eskom coal fleet. The extent to which the EAF, the availability factor of the Eskom coal fleet, in our view, in the immediate term, is going to have a far bigger impact in terms of when new forms of capacity need to be built. Also, just to stress that the changes in the load forecast simply change when you have to build new capacity. It doesn't change what type of capacity you build. And in all of those scenarios, from a least cost mix, it really is a combination of flexibility with renewable energy sources. There are a number of new technology options that have been touched on that present opportunities for the South African energy system to reduce some of the dependency on, for example, gas in the future energy mix. So mention has been made in terms of the security of the future energy system and the dependency on future gas. In all of the scenarios, gas plays a relatively small role in terms of the energy mix, and there's a lot of opportunity to displace a lot of those gas molecules with locally manufactured flexibility options such as battery storage systems. I would also like to then pose the following questions to the department. Firstly, what process will be followed by the department to unpack the areas of further work that have been identified by the DOE, given their critical importance going forward? And then furthermore, how will future iterations of the IRP manage the critical link to the existing Eskom coal fleet performance? Thank you. The second one. So the second one is, how will the future iterations of the IRP manage the critical link to the existing Eskom coal fleet performance?
Yes, ma'am. It appears you are the last person.
Hi, my name is Nicole Orza. I'm from the Center for Environmental Rights. I just have two short questions. One is whether the Department of Energy has made a determination on whether or not the coal IPP projects are value for money. This is something that's legally required before a power purchase agreement can be signed. And then I note your comment about the commitment of the department to the coal IPP is about not letting investors down. But the Minister of Energy has also acknowledged that these coal projects are going to cost South Africa an extra 23 billion rand. So it's not okay to let investors down, but it is okay to make South Africans pay a lot more for electricity and also to build two of the most greenhouse gas emission intensive coal plants in the world. So we obviously have an objection to that. And then another question just is, whether has the Department of Energy consulted with NERSA in relation to the IRP? Thank you.
Ask legal questions. You had your hand up a long time ago. Yes, you can please go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm Professor Winkler from the Energy Research Center at the University of Cape Town. I would also like to thank the department for the presentation, and we have submitted in writing some further comments. I wanted to start in engaging with this in the demand discussion, because it's just recalling a bit of history that, and saying that both over and under supply are very expensive to our economy. And during the 1980s and 90s, we mothballed a whole lot of power plants and then returned them to service. That's a very, very costly process. After 2008, most of us will still remember we had undersupply and we had load shedding, which is also costly to our economy and society. And that's why smaller, modular, flexible technologies are really important. And here I very much agree with my colleague from UCT next to me. We're at the university chair. We often take the right to disagree with each other vehemently, but here I really agree. Just again and again, the actual demand that we see is outside of what we call the cone of projection. So Professor Gaunt called for a high and a low range. And in fact, the IRP itself shows this. It shows in Figure 3. That actual demand is significantly below the previous projections, but it seems to persist with, nonetheless, making yet again a higher projection, which almost certainly, while we don't know what it will be, almost certainly will, even the lower projection will be too high while we are currently in a recession. And this has serious implications, not just for the utility, for ESCOM, but also for local government. And we would also like to see much more detail on modeling energy efficiency and DSM interventions. As you may know from the department, we have a group doing measurement and verification of those interventions, and we've put those into our submission. Chair, we do think, and here I'll be brief because others have touched on this, but we do think that the IRP doesn't speak well enough and is missing some of the major trends that we are facing. The presentation very clearly spoke to a very rapidly changing system, but distributed generation and decentralized systems we're going to have a very different electricity system in the future, which will be different to the big power plants and big networks that we've had in the past. This is a trend that is happening globally, and that is starting to happen in South Africa, and it really shifts power, both technically and also politically, and it has really important implications, and we think that the kind of exercise that we're engaging with, and very thankful to have this public debate, should really take those trends very seriously and see how is this plan robust to shifting us from our current system to one that is significantly more decentralized. And I won't go into others have spoken, I think, compellingly about the importance of storage. We could only find reference to pumped storage, but really the developments in battery storage, not only by Elon Musk over in California, but by UWC down the road has an energy storage innovation lab that is looking at this. The key question is affordability. It doesn't come for free, but we think that that's very important in this more distributed system. And then on some of the key points that have been raised, others before me have said we've been part of a study looking at coal IPPs. There's no question that they add costs, energy system costs, and of course greenhouse gas emissions. And James has spoken to the special report from the IPCC on 1.5. So here we do have a question, direct question to the Department of whether the DOE wouldn't consider an approach to decommissioning that, rather than taking what seems to us an arbitrary 50-year lifespan, take an endogenous approach to decommissioning, by which we essentially mean when it's no longer economic to run a station, and we are particularly talking about coal-fired power stations, then that, together with some other factors, would be the basis on when you would actually decommission that station. And my colleague Jesse Burton over there is an author on a study. We've done a detailed study on this and put into our submission a summary of coal supply risks by station. And if you start looking at what this actually looks like, this goes to issues like when contracts for coal actually expire. We actually really need to look at the decommissioning schedule much more closely, and we will ask the question to the department is if they would consider such an approach. We'd be very happy to work with them in that regard. And then just to also endorse what others have said, of course the matter of a just transition is absolutely essential. There are many people, communities, depending on coal mines, coal-fired power stations. It's essential that there's a managed decline of coal-fired power. We do know, Chair, that coming out of the recent just summit, there was a framework agreement which included reference to a just transition, and it's planning to establish a statutory body, a presidential climate change coordinating committee that would oversee such a just transition. Chair, it was interesting to hear the department explain on build limits. We don't understand why they would be imposed if they constrain, although we noted that they do, that the department views that they do not constrain before 2030, but we believe that they should be higher, and our own analysis, our own modeling at the ERC, they are higher. But we'd also point out that some time ago, other technical solutions, using the Plexus model, which you and others also use, basically just doing better temporal resolution of dispatch modeling is a good, if the concern is fundamentally grid flexibility, which we think is a valid concern, then there are ways of actually introducing that factor into modeling. And there was an NREL, the U.S. National Renewable Energy Lab, which I'm sure you would be aware of, a study on audit team specifically looking at South Africa's IRP and suggesting that there are other ways than simply limiting how much can be built. Two more points, Chair. Environmental and social implications are very important. We're happy to see, we find it very interesting to see the carbon budgets that are in there. We believe for various reasons that 5 years would be better than 10, most notably the urgency of climate action. 10 years is simply too long to update. But we propose a way of basing that on at least cost mitigation analysis rather than some numbers which we can't quite follow. It's really crucial that the plan does meet air quality standards under the Air Quality Act and considers water costs. And again, we've put forward some numbers that we ourselves use. And then lastly, on process, we really thank the department for what they presented here, and it enables us to better understand, but we think that transparency is a really important matter. We publish our own energy model on our website, and we would really appreciate if the full Flixos modeling data, methodologies and assumptions would be published by the DOE so that those of us that may not be who go further than just a simple spreadsheet could actually replicate those results and actually understand where those are coming from. And then the very final point is just about timeframes, which is that we've noted that the modelling seems to go out to 2050, but the plan then only goes to 2030. And when the last official IRP was published in 2011, it went to 2013. That was a 19-year plan. So now, if this comes, we're basically looking at a 12-year plan. We think that the long-term perspective is actually really important, and so we actually think that the 2050 perspective should come in to inform the near term, even nearer than 11 or 12 years, and that's why we also support those who say that we believe there should be an annual or at least every 2 years an update of the IRP. Thank you very much, Chair.
That's the last thing. Come back to DOE. Sir, you can go on. You can speak. Is your mic on?
I don't have a mic.
Chairperson, I just want to comment. It's okay if you're going to shut me up, because we have been shut out. At 108 of 1996, the Constitution does not include the Aboriginal, Indigenous, Khoisan Nation people. Therefore, I listen and I hear, and I do not want to speak. I cannot speak because we do not have any effect. We do not have any impact on political persuasions within Parliament, which, by the way, stands on very sacred land, according to my nation. So all I want to say, Chairperson, it's sad. We are 5 months and 27 days away from 25 years of exclusion. And we've been speaking since 1980 to include us. And it's all about, when you speak about energy, a lot of us is about the land. It's about this venerable, ancestral, sacred heritage land, blood ground, and spiritual home. So therefore, say thank you for allowing me to speak, and I may sound different and difficult, but it's because of that exclusion. And it's useless to have this Kara means people, but the people have been excluded, Chairperson. Therefore, what is my contribution? It cannot be from my nation's perspective, and for me to be silent, Chairperson, would mean that I'm guilty. I must speak here. People may not like what I say. People may hate me. That's fine. But I'm not going away. I must speak this truth. Everybody came. Everybody interacted and connected with us. Not the other way around. We have been excluded. And anybody that has any... Well, so argue about that, the protector of the Constitution, which is the Chief Justice of South Africa, Mogoeng said this on the 8th of August in a castle. Truly, the Aboriginal Khoisan Nation has been excluded. Therefore, Chairperson, I really rest my case, but it's an onslaught that hasn't stopped. for 365 years and nearly 5 months. And it's ongoing. It's ongoing. And I must say this because I must become a living prophetic witness for my nation. And the three of us sitting over there. And therefore, thank you, Chairperson, for allowing me to speak. I'm off beat, I'm off track, but it's the fly against the wall sitting in my sacred land and listening to people speaking about the rape of the land. But the rape of the people have taken preference. Therefore, the erasure of this nation, it's shocking. Aya Ganga.
Thank you very much. The bishop is going away for praying for us. DOE, can you respond?
Thanks, Chair. There were a number of questions. There were, I think the questions that I picked up started around the issue of externalities. We have seen the presentation that was presented last week. We haven't gone through the detailed submission. I know they presented different numbers to the ones we're using. Obviously, we have to go and understand the numbers and the source, and then we can only, obviously, as part of the detailed process, have a view on those numbers. So we haven't done the analysis. There was a point that was also made around the fact that there are no CO2 constraints. The PBD that we apply in the model is exactly that, and that's why we don't impose carbon tax on top of that, you know, because we believe that we're already constraining the emissions. So you're actually imposing a constraint on the technology already by saying that it cannot exceed a certain amount of emissions. There was a comments which were made by ESCOM around gas. I think we agree. That's why one of the studies that we've raised is that we need to go and do detailed work on the sources of gas to better inform the next iteration of the IRP. I know that there's a team in the department that's actually working on the gas master plan, and that will provide further clarity, hopefully, as soon as it's available. In terms of there was a question from the CSIR with regard to the process. We're still going through the submissions, but what we can see already, there are distinctions. There are technical issues, which are more modeling issues and assumption issues that we'll have to go through. Together with the IRP technical team, we'll look at those. And we might obviously reach out to those that have made comments to get clarity on some of the issues that they're raising to better understand them. You know, because some of these things we may find that is a miscommunication or misunderstanding around the issues. And there are other issues that we already see that they are policy-related issues, and obviously those ones the department will engage with. Then there was the how are we going to manage the future iteration in relation to the issues. I think at the moment we've always said that one of the things that we need to monitor going forward as a department is the medium-term system outlook from ESCOM to make sure that we interrogate it and to make sure that we look at what it says with regard to the performance and operation of the system. And in that regard, we'll have a sense if we are deviating, it's deviating from what we had projected in the IRP. There was a question around from CR in terms of have we consulted the regulator. Yes, I mean the IRP is developed, part of the technical team has an official from the regulator, but the regulator members have also submitted formal comments on the IRP. Chair, I think from the ERC we note the comments, and as I said, most of them are of technical nature. We will engage with the submission, and where necessary, we'll engage the ERC direct on some of the specific issues that they've raised. Thank you.
very much. I think I want to hear if the honorable members have anything to say before we close. So you have heard. So we will proceed to finalize our report, which will obviously contain many of the things that you have been saying here. So the department is in possession of your submissions, some of the things you said here and those that you submitted directly. So as both the DG and Mr. Mbele said, on issues that may require further engagement, so there will be direct communication to ensure that there's meaningful consultation on these matters. So just to make the point that we're not ticking the box. So to the extent possible, those things, and there are many that have been raised that I think are possible to be looked at. So, DG, I don't know what you have to say about the last comment that you received. I'm going to once I allow you to speak, I'm not going to allow anybody to speak after that. Okay, Honorable Mahambehlala.
Thanks, Chair PC. Chair, I've got few clarities. Now that the department is here today. And allow me also to greet my former boss from Eskom.
Which one? There are many.
Good to see you. You know,
there are many people from Eskom.
And others were never my bosses. You know,
they are very serious. They looking at the same laptops and the red lights there. So I don't know. All of them are concentrated on a laptop.
They can look, but they were never my former bosses, those ones. I'm referring to Mr. Chos.
Are you watching the performance of the system? Okay. I saw your former boss.
Reading the RIP5, there's a point there, Chair, that refers to significant change that assumed or assumes the decommissioning of a nuclear plant in Quebec. Now, when I read that sentence, and in fact, it suggests that renewable and gas are now the dominant energy suppliers. When I read that, I was reminded of one country which is now busy phasing out nuclear. Now, I want to ask the department, because you speak in parables when you write these things, the communication is not clear. I've learned one thing today. Now, I must ask this question. Are you suggesting or assuming an indirect phasing out of nuclear? Because that sentence for me is very loud and it has undertones. Myself, I'm not a witch doctor, so I don't want to assume anything. You know, last week in the submissions, we had people up in arms about the new coal inclusion. And in simple terms, in your presentation, you were referring to the Midupi and Kusile completion. And like those people who were up in arms, I thought that you are bringing something else. So the way you write your things sometimes, it confuses the whole nation. But today I'm clarified. Now, Che, that South Africa just released a report. It says that the unemployment rate in South Africa rises to 27.5%. Now, the decommissioning of coal suggests that there will be some citizens of this country that will be unemployed. Now, I want to check how this will be done, because it's important for us to be ready. And in so doing, what are you going to do with the 66 billion tons in the reserves? The 66 billion tons of coal in the reserves, what are you going to do with those if you are decommissioning coal? And the possibility of using technologies to clean our coal, how much are they? Is there such technology existing in our country? And then if there's such technology existing in our country, why not using the technology to clean coal instead of decommissioning the coal that is so much in our reserves? The RIP chairperson, it puzzles me when it says that they acknowledge that nuclear is a contributing factor, or the role of nuclear in the NDP. It's also acknowledged, né? But in the same vein, they want to investigate. They want to investigate cost and financing of nuclear. Now, I'm reminded here that at some point we were about to implement the nuclear build program. Was there no investigation conducted then? And the cost of nuclear at that point, it was clear that 80% was going to come from the vendor countries, and that is the country we're going to contribute 20%. And at some point, I remember the portfolio suggested that we have a conversation on nuclear and have a panel discussion that includes all the parties, the for and the against. Because the issue of cost of nuclear, it has been disputed by various experts, and the trillion in particular. And that came out of the presentations that we made here since last week. Last question, Chair. Is the inclusion of Grand Inga realistic in the RIP? Is it realistic? And I think, did you know why am I asking this question? Because we've been talking about Grand Inga since our arrival in Parliament, 2014. And our term of office is now nearing the end. And Grand Inga has never been implemented, and there has been no progress on Grand Inga. But now you are including Grand Inga on the RIP. Who's fooling whom? Now, probably your clarity will assist me. Is it realistic for us or for the department to include Grand Inga on the RIP? On the modeling, the department was here, and the list cost was rubbished by many people who presented. Some even said that it is incorrect, it's inaccurate, and so forth and so on. Now, I think instead of saying you got the modeling from Plexus and whatever tools that you have used. Here we use tools of analysis. We don't know the tools that you have used there. I think it's important for you to go back and reconsider this thing of remodeling, because majority of people who presented, they have reservations on the lease cost and the modeling chairperson. And I think the department also must tell us the rationale behind not including nuclear now, but 2030. What's the difference between 2030 and now? Because for me, it doesn't make sense. Because we don't know whether by 2030 some of us will be still alive or dead. So the assumption for me is way unrealistic. Why not include nuclear now? So I think those are the clarities, so that when we go back and deliberate on these issues which are raised here, all of us, we deliberate from an informed point of view, Chairperson, because I think that is important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you very much for the issues and the questions and concerns that are being raised by Honorable Mohamed Thad. Chair, maybe let me repeat on the issue of the Inga project, which specifically the Honorable Member has raised, because it's a matter that is governed by an existing treaty, as you will know, and again we still have an obligation to come back to the committee just to provide some updates on the progress to date that has been transpiring on the treaty side. Suffice to say, Chair, the government is part of the treaty with certain obligations that we have made, which we cannot pull out from for a number of reasons within the region. And therefore, Chair, as DDG has tried to explain, we are still part of that arrangement, and the context of having Inga as being part of the exercise, it's a reflection of our commitment that we have made into that treaty, which has been built into the assumptions and the outcomes of the exercise that we have taken into consideration. But Chair, we will provide the detail when we provide the update to this committee as a standard practice of where the process is. There is a process, it is continuing, the project is continuing, and there are developments that have transpired into that. Then the issues around the nuclear, Chair, I think we can also ask Mpela to reflect on the assumptions that we have made. But we have taken cognizance, as Honourable Member is indicating, that the submissions we have received are talking into some issues that she has raised. But we haven't done the analysis to test those analyses against the assumptions that we have used based on the modelling that we have used so as to conclude. So we started a process of engagement and to receive submissions and then test that against the assumptions that we have made on different energy mixes that we are dealing with. So we haven't concluded, Chair, on the assumptions we have made, but we have outlined the basics or the scientific basis on how we have arrived at the modeling and the assumptions we have made. And of course, we are considering the submissions that we have received as of last week, some of which have not even been presented to the portfolio committee, but submitted by different experts in different fields on the matter. So we have not concluded on those assumptions, Chair. We will still receive your report that you'll be giving to us also, and then build that into our work we have done and test that against our modeling and the key assumptions and the scenarios we have made, and then finalize the process. So we have just reflected on that, Chair. I don't think you'd like us to go back and explain how we have done our key assumptions and modeling. That might take time. But we have not concluded. So whatever we have received as of last week and today, we will be testing that. Also, your report, Chair, that will be coming through, which forms part of that, and test against the key assumptions we have made and the modeling we have used, and then reflect on that and also inform this leadership appropriately on the finality of that process. So we haven't done those analyses, Chair. So I wouldn't like, therefore, to comment it at this stage to that until that exercise based on the submissions we have received is actually done. Otherwise, I'll be preempting what could be the possible outcome moving forward, which I wouldn't like to take a risk on.
That was made around the statement we made around the significant change post 2030. It was not necessarily just reflecting to the fact that we'll be decommissioning Quebec. The point we're making, and maybe it doesn't come out clear in the write-up and we'll have to rewrite it, but the point we're making is that if you look at the quantum of decommission that happens even with coal, it's so significant that we cannot just assume that you'll replace it with gas and wind. Hence, we're saying there's a significant change and we need to take a pause and engage on what we're seeing and make sure that the mix beyond 2030 does not obviously discriminate or impact on what we have on the ground. That's the point that we were trying to make, and maybe it's not coming out our clear, Chair. The issue around the decommissioning, I think, is the same point. We had indicated that the significant decommissioning post 2030, I think it goes close to about 40 gigawatts, and we're saying with that amount of decommissioning, obviously you cannot just say this is the path that you want to take. We're saying there needs to be a detailed and robust engagement before the next iteration of the IRP so that the decisions we make are obviously in the best interest of the country. Those are the two main ones, Chair, that I think I had to respond to. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Potentially we will still speak to the DOE when we busy with the finalization of our report on issues that we still want to clarify ourselves as a committee before we finalize our report. So we will engage with you on some of the things that are still unclear, and especially where members of the committee have views on how to proceed. So I think we should stop here for today, and thank you very much. And especially for those who attended for the last 5 days and today. So I think we should adjourn. Unfortunately, the bishop has left, but we will ask him to come to the DOE on the day that they finalize in their draft, because they might need a prayer.
Yeah.
There are too many contending views that you've got to consider here. It's not going to be easy. But good luck, and thanks very much to everybody who attended. The meeting is adjourned.
Yeah, this is quite a difficult subject, but I've been here at meetings with this particular one, we go on to 5, sometimes even 7 o'clock. And the problem is if you park a car anywhere that is not safe. Yes, no. Some start at 8, some at 9. But the reason...